Hello and welcome back to the Sustaining Sport podcast. When you think of sports pundits, you think of famous faces, beloved, ultra-successful former players whose time on the field means only they can see the inner layer of the games that they played. While this is certainly true a lot of the time, are they always giving the best possible analysis that is available? Ben Nurse, my guest today, argues that they do not, and he raises some compelling points to support his case. In this episode, we discuss, amongst other things, what has led to this complacency amongst rugby union pundits, why leveraging data analytics is becoming more and more essential within the game of rugby, and how a YouTuber from Wales shows that you do not have to have played the international game to know the international game. Please enjoy today's episode. So welcome, Ben, to the Sustaining Sport podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
You're very welcome. So you have caused a bit of a stir, particularly in the rugby Twitter community, with an article you wrote recently about punditry in the Six Nations. So let me start by saying, when did the idea for this article occur to you, and you know, how long have you been brewing with these emotions?
It was a pretty long-running narrative. It's been going on for a few years where a lot of seriously passionate rugby fans like myself have been pretty dissatisfied with the Six Nations coverage, especially in comparison to some other providers. I mentioned BT Sport do some really good stuff. In other countries, I know Premier, RTE as well do the same. But I thought especially this year, we felt especially unsatisfied with the coverage. I felt that a lot of the pundits who appear on TV every single year, this year they came especially unprepared. A lot of the stuff they said, they seemed to recycle from week to week. And a lot of the stuff they said was slightly inflammatory. And I just felt that they can definitely do better.
Yes. And I mean, I must say, when I saw your article, it was music to my ears. And the number of people who I sort of had mentioned this to in the last couple of weeks, you know, they were sort of saying, Ben, what do you want about? But I was so pleased to see, other rugby fans out there picking up on a similar trend, because I think we were all sitting there at halftime, you know, listening to these people talk and being a bit confused at why they are the ones having this platform when there are a lot of rugby voices out there that don't. To sort of summarize the article, but I'd encourage the listeners to go read it in its full. Ben was criticizing how the likes of Sir Clive Woodward, Johnny Wilkinson on the ITV and BBC coverage were completely unprepared for discussing the teams that were presented to them, and particularly certain individuals, certain players that have been on the scene for a long time. They would make a generic comment about their performance in the first half or whatever, having had no prior understanding of who they are or how they are in the youth ranks, anything like that, where there are analysts out there who do have that insight. Do you think there are any rugby pundits out there that are being able to sort of stay up to the pace with things?
Oh no, for sure. I mentioned BT Sport before. I love listening to their pundits. I love Rugby Tonight was a great program. I love watching BT Sport highlights. People like David Flatman, Ugo Monya, Austin Healy, I mentioned, Ben Kay. They do amazingly well. You can tell they do their research and they're really great analysis. This is the kind of stuff that we want to see on our TVs. And this is why it's so frustrating that the BBC and ITV, who are public service broadcasters who get the most funding out of any rugby provider and the most backing, that they can't really keep up. And obviously, it's more frustrating when BBC and ITV frequently hire many of the BT Sport pundits, like Ugo Monya, like a few others, and then they don't use them in their coverage all the time. Instead, they choose to use people like Sir Clive Woodward and Johnny Wilkinson, who you could argue haven't been keeping up with modern rugby, and they seem to prove it every time they go on TV by, I guess, not knowing certain players and not knowing certain modern trends.
Yes. And why do you think that is? Why do you think BBC and ITV are holding on to these older big names rather than trying to look for perhaps more cutting edge voices?
There's a bad thing in rugby, which is that we rely on tradition a lot. Rugby, especially more than other sports, we have an attitude of we do it this way because we've always done it this way. So the Six Nations brand very much relies on these characters because they're on our TVs every year and they have been for almost a decade now. You look at Clive Woodward. He stopped managing in 2005. He stopped coaching in 2005. And he almost immediately transitioned from then into punditry. So he's been on our TVs. Him and Jonathan Davis have been on our TVs for at least over a decade now. And so I feel that BBC and ITV see them as the faces of their brand. But eventually we have to get to the point, especially now in rugby, where we're very much in a transitional phase. We have to get to the point where we start to look at new ways of showing the product.
Yes. And I think from a South African perspective, the best South African comparison is Naspoorter. Naspoorter was, you know, one of the great Springbok players in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, it was a really technically gifted player and was, you know, very smart and intelligent player. And I must say, when he first transitioned into punditry, he was outstanding. But we are talking, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it just, from, you know, my perspective growing up watching rugby, it just seemed to get worse and worse as things got older. And I think he reached the end of the line right after South Africa had won the World Cup final in 2019, live on air saying that the police should waive the drink driving rules just because everyone will be drinking and celebrating. And I'm just like, okay, I think that's it. He is talking from a very interesting bit of insight, but he's talking about a game of rugby that's not the same. He's talking about rugby from the late 80s and the game's not played the same. How do you think pundits could go about staying up to date? Or is it a case of when they get to a certain age, they just can't?
Well, I'm super into my stats and analysis. I believe it's the future of rugby and of sport. I also believe it's the present. I look at comparing rugby to other sports, and we don't have anywhere near the sophistication with analysis and stats and data as other popular sports. So many people like to say that, oh, people hate analysis. They turn off their TV when you hear it. But if you look at any sport, any popular sport these days, especially in America, in basketball and American football, it's very much numbers and data driven, and they love it. You know, if you look at any popular debates which get engagement in sports social media, you look at LeBron James versus Michael Jordan or Cristiano Ronaldo versus Lionel Messi. When you look at those debates, the first thing that people mention when they compare players like this is numbers and data. They'll say, oh, LeBron had this many more points, but Ronaldo had this many more assists. And you don't see that same thing in rugby. And yet, a lot of people have the attitude that they don't want to see the transition into more analysis and stats and data because people don't want to see it. But if we've never tried it, if we've only had the status quo for this many years, we don't know that it's not going to work. And I definitely believe that the younger generation, especially, they love this kind of thing. They love numbers. They love analysis.
Yes, I think more definitely a case of why the older generation is, dare I say, even nervous or a bit anxious about the incoming data is that a lot of them don't have those basic IT soft skills, which I think the younger generation take for granted just by growing up with the technology that was available to them. So it's a bigger barrier to entry for them to become accustomed to sort of a lot of these data analytics tools than it would be for some of the younger analysts, pundits, this kind of thing. But yeah, it does, of course, leave certain people and certain teams vulnerable if they don't take this route. Because I agree, you know, I don't want everything to be reduced to numbers. I don't want like the spirit and the passion and the emotion of the game to be reduced to numbers. But at the same time, I agree with your statement. It is the future. And I think, yeah, football is a good comparison where Manchester City, Liverpool, these teams at the apex of the game, really, you know, you can just tell from behind the scenes and you hear one or two words about it. They have such strong data analytics teams in their backroom staff so that when the manager is making certain decisions, it's coming from this place of very strong historical context and data. And then you'll have a pundit who will say, oh, I don't know why they did that, as if because he's been watching the game for half an hour. It just doesn't sort of land very well for me.
You're 100% right. It helps explain the game. It opens your eyes to what's going on. The nuances, especially. People say, oh, the Six Nations, it brings in a lot more casual fans. So you need to dumb down the coverage so they know what's going on. But I just think that's the complete opposite attitude to have, because when you dumb down things, it makes things a lot less clear. When on BT Sport, if they overanalyze a certain play and show why a certain runner was running a certain line and why a passing option was short rather than long, it helps open your eyes to nuances about the game. And I feel like adding more analysis to the Six Nations can only bring in more fans. They'll see the nuances and the things that make it so enjoyable.
And I think, you know, it's amazing that we still are having this conversation this many years down the line after, you know, we have seen examples from other sports where they have broken the system in this way. I think the most famous example is definitely the whole Moneyball approach taken by the Oakland A's in the baseball, where one team realized with data they could find value in players that the old guard of scouts could not see. it put them on an unprecedented winning run in doing that. And very quickly, a lot of other teams adopted it. And it's funny that that has been adopted in other sports from a team's perspective. And it's also interesting because it's being adopted quite drastically in the gambling industry. You know, these gambling companies are running huge amounts of data to be able to give the most accurate and favorable to themselves odds on games. But the group that seemed to be leading this behind are the ones who are delivering us analysis, you know, delivering to the public analysis. So it's a bit confusing why that is.
No, 100%. I'm not privy to any coaching or playing setups in the top divisions, but I'm almost certain that these numbers will run the game. I read a great article about Leicester Tigers. They rebuilded from being rock bottom of the Premiership and their first place at the moment. And a lot of what they did was they brought in statisticians and they took the Moneyball method. They brought in players who excelled in one certain stat so that they could get certain workloads completed. They would bring in players who topped tackle charts in other leagues because they needed more tackling. And a lot of what they did in their rebuild was based on the Moneyball principles and stats, basically.
Yes. And maybe I'm being too harsh, but what I want from pundits is to deliver me that analysis work that I don't, as a, you know, just as a fan, have the time to do. A classic example might be maybe a Premiership side signs a certain type of flanker and the pundits of the moment will say, oh, I don't know why they signed him. He's not very good, or something like that. Whereas, you know, what I want is that level of analysis, like, oh, the reason they've signed him is because he's good at this very specific task. And because the general consensus is he's not very good, the team were able to get him on a very good deal, like for a good price. It's that one step deeper analysis that I want, so that when I'm watching it, I'm not sitting there being, oh, he's not very good because Johnny Wilkinson, for example. I don't want to pick on Johnny Wilkinson the whole time, but Johnny Wilkinson said he's not very good. What I would rather do is hear that, oh, so we've heard about his contract. You know, you want your pundits to have done that analysis. Whereas it seems like more, yeah, they just sort of get up there every weekend and, you know, they haven't done their prep and they just, I suppose, cashing their paychecks.
No, yeah, 100%. Like, one of the comments I highlighted in my article was Johnny Wilkinson. Sorry, Johnny. But he said that he was explaining why playing people out of position in rugby doesn't work. And we know from modern trends that that's simply not true. The game we have today is almost positionless. Numbers on the back of shirts are almost meaningless at this point. So for him to explain that principle, which was true in his playing day, but we know not to be true today, is especially frustrating because it's in a situation where a lot of social media influencers and social media analysts have a better understanding of the modern game than a lot of people that are on TV on the national broadcasters.
Do you think it might be a case we've been treating these legends of the game with almost too much reverence? I'm almost suspicious that, and yeah, I'm going to try and find these guys an excuse almost, that for the last 10 years, they've been leaving the studio and no one has turned to them and said, oh, you know, great work today. But by the way, I'm not sure about that comment. We almost have just been sitting back and saying, oh, their word is law, so we're not going to push back. And maybe we've like unintentionally lured them into a false sense of believing that their word is law.
The nostalgia is a massive element. Like, I could definitely see the divide in the reaction to my article between people who were too young to remember the World Cup final in 2003 and people who weren't English. Like, I had loads of support from South Africans, from Welshmen, from Scotsmen, from Irishmen. And the majority of the people who disliked my article and gave me a negative reaction were people who were old enough to see the 2003 World Cup final and who were English, because the nostalgia for them of seeing Johnny Wilkinson and Clive Woodward win that World Cup is enough to give them, I guess, a lifetime pass for them to do whatever they want, which obviously I understand. But me not being old enough to watch in 2003, I guess I can look at the situation now with a bit more clarity and a bit more partiality.
Yes. And it is strange because I do feel like, of course, you mentioned the game has changed, but even the way coaches approach the game has changed. You know, if you compare that sort of, you know, 2003 World Cup run, people relied on more things like, for example, passion and sort of culture and this kind of stuff to get the most out of their team. Whereas, you know, you look back as recently as 2019, that South Africa side felt so tactically drilled. You know, it was very much from the analysis board, from the data board. Okay, what exact things do we need to target? What exact things do we need to do? I think the best example in terms of tactics was the box kick. And I will put my hand up and say, in the build-up to that 2019 World Cup, you know, Faf de Klerk launching box kick after box kick after box kick, it drove me up the wall from how I'd used to approach the game. But then, of course, it was based in data analysis and sound strategy, and it paid off. But yeah, if luckily I wasn't a paid pundit at the time, but it's amazing how few of the paid pundits seem to realize that during that coverage.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. The current South Africa international team are the perfect example of the money ball approach. They play the box kicking game, like you say, which basically just relies on if the ball is always in the opposition 22, eventually they'll make a mistake and that's when you strike on it. What seems like Wales or New Zealand will play more old-fashioned games in that they'll rely on individuals and instincts, whereas South Africa, it's calculated to the millisecond. And obviously, they won the last World Cup and they're a pretty good team. So we can conclude it does work.
Yeah, I just think it's funny that when teams try these new things, there is often from the pundits like, oh, that's not how rugby's played, or, oh, that's not within the spirit of the game. And I'm like, but if a team has found a, shall we say, a loophole or some kind of area within the law that hasn't, you know, otherwise been realized and have applied a tactic to it and they succeed, they're going to do that until they change the law. So the pundit shouldn't be angry at the team for finding the hole. They should either say, okay, they need to change the law and give a justification of why they changed the law, or almost pat the team on the back and said, well done, you found a cool way to win.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I refer to when I say modern trends, is that the 50-22 is a perfect example of the way that the game has been tweaked and the way that modern coaches are trying to make the most of it. So a lot of the commentators had very little to say over the Six Nations about the 50-22 rule change, but it completely changed the championship. It completely changes the way that you defend in the front field and in the backfield, and it completely changed the way that teams attack. Teams, especially France this year in the Six Nations, kicked way more than they have in previous years, because tactical kicking is so much more part of the game now than it was before. And very little of the Six Nations coverage really delved into that at all. Whereas we could see it all over Twitter. We could see it very much in what BT Sport do with the Premiership.
Yes. And I think on that topic, we definitely have to bring up our friend Squidge Rugby, who
he sort of
changed the game in terms of what I would call a fan's analysis very quickly converting into the mainstream. And I would even say myself, as a diehard longtime rugby fan from South Africa, he's almost my first port of call now when it comes to how, you know, if I want to watch an analysis of a game or sort of understand how a team's playing, he's the first one to come to mind, which is quite miraculous considering he's a little bit like me. He's just sort of a dude in his 20s making videos out of his bedroom.
Yeah, he's the best case study we have for just a normal guy who just understands the game so well. Like, someone tweeted me when this all blew up and said, what exactly qualifies you to say this, that you know this much about modern rugby? And I basically said that, well, this is the attitude I'm trying to challenge, is that I don't have to have played for England in the 1990s to know the modern game. And Squidge is a perfect example. He knows more about the modern game of rugby than a lot of current coaches are, I'd assume. And he does it in a way which he explains it so well. Anyone with any level of rugby knowledge can watch the Squidge Rugby YouTube video and they can finish it more knowledgeable than when they started it, and they can say that they follow the video throughout, even though what he's talking about is very advanced stuff. But he does it in a way which he explains it so well.
Yes, he's another perfect example. I know he's quite a keen touch rugby player, but he is not an international rugby player.
No.
And, you know, he doesn't have a degree. Well, I don't think he has a degree in like data science or something like that. But at the same time, he's got the skill set to be able to access that data. And he gives you what I would call the most like relevant to the fans data. You know, he'll give you that stat around how much they kicked in previous seasons or that kind of stuff, where, you know, there's a lot of number points that you need to look at, but we as the fan don't want the whole thing and we can't have the whole thing, but we're relying on our analyzers / pundits to provide that for us. And I think he does such a good job doing that.
It's also the inclusivity. Like, Switch famously loves to do videos on Uruguay, on USA, on Spain, on Portugal. Whereas a thing that I mentioned in the Six Nations was that they barely mentioned Italy. It was one of the most exciting Italy teams that I've ever seen in my life. They beat Wales and they played fantastic rugby throughout. But we failed to get really any substantial comment on the Italy team. I remember at one point, Johnny Wilkinson was asked about Paolo Garbisi, who is the Italy fly half and one of the best players in the world at the moment. And he basically said that he doesn't really know much about him, which obviously for us rugby fans who watch rugby all year round and we all love Paolo Garbisi, it's frustrating again.
Yes, I think the inclusivity point is a very good one. And I think, to Squidge's credit, he also does women's rugby. And that leads me to this point around gender. And I'd like to get your take on this. I have found that when they do allow female punditry and even commentary around other sports, and I am talking sort of former female athletes, but then ask them to comment on the men's game, on the male game, they often can be more insightful and more well-researched because I think they feel the pressure. I think because they're like, I'm the first woman that's been allowed in this role, I really need to make sure I do my stuff. They absolutely nail it. I think the famous one around football is Alex Scott. She really absolutely has such good insights when it comes to her punditry efforts. I think in cricket in South Africa, we've done very well. I know cricket's a slightly different game in terms of how the commentary and the punditry works, but you know, they've rotated a lot of female analysis in. And yeah, I just think the female pundits have the opposite of, shall we say, that old boys quality, where they have had to work so hard to be in this punditry role, whereas the others, it's a byproduct of their careers. I'm not sure what you think about that.
No, I agree with you. It's a weird dynamic where a lot of the people on TV, I don't believe are there for merit, but many of the women on TV, that they're 100% there on merit. Like, I'm frustrated that I didn't mention Gabby Logan in my article because she's exempt from any negative comments that I said. She's always brilliant. She's very knowledgeable about rugby. And her presenting style, I love. Sara Elgin on BT Sport as well is amazing. And I definitely think media as a sector is dominated by older white men. But I think rugby has made some great steps in terms of inclusivity, in terms of getting different types of people involved in broadcasting.
Yes. I do sometimes think, though, when it comes to how these media companies have brought in women, they have taken sometimes what I would call the softest approach, where they put them as a presenter rather than an expert, which is quite funny because that's the easiest role to fill, as in they don't have to find someone from the game. They can find someone who's just a good presenter. So I think the next level, and I'm not saying no one's done it, the next level is definitely bringing on female experts. And then I think the level beyond that is if you were to bring on a female expert who has no background in the game, but, you know, perhaps did something like Squidge does. I think the moment that, shall we say, what some of the older rugby fans can stomach a 22-year-old woman from her bedroom giving more sage rugby analysis than the likes of Sir Clive Woodward, that is when the game is on a good place in terms of inclusive and cutting edge analysis.
That is the crux of the issue, is that no one would ever admit it directly, or maybe they would, but a lot of older male rugby fans would have an issue with being told about rugby by a younger woman, even though they do know more about rugby than them. I think some people would have reservations with that. And that, obviously, that's going to be a time thing. It's going to be, as time goes on, we will start to see more women in these roles and people will start to be more comfortable with it. But I would 100% rather have someone like Maggie Alfonsi doing an expert role than a lot of people who are on BBC at the moment.
And yeah, I think we're not just saying they should put in some kind of quota system where, like, oh, we need more non-white representation, we need more females. I'm saying we obviously need to find the people from those demographics that have that expertise, that are there on merit always. And I think, you know, even if we use Squidge as an example, we're not talking about him because he's young. That's not what makes him exciting. It's that he's proven that he has that level of analysis. And I think this Six Nations really highlighted that when, as you say, the coverage didn't really cover Italy that well, particularly in the build-up. And then, you know, Squidge was putting out videos before the tournament started, sort of saying, listen, this is one of the most exciting Italian teams we've seen in a long time. He obviously referenced their youth setup a lot. Then, you know, didn't change his tone when Italy got quite heavily defeated in the early games. So for them to come out and beat Wales in the tournament is, yeah, I saw it as slight justification for Squidge's level of expertise versus some of the incumbents.
I think Squidge is yet to be wrong on topics like this. He's predicted many things that people could never predict. And it always feels like he's going to be wrong. You know, at the start of this tournament, Italy weren't playing the best. And Squidge said from game number one, they will win a game this year. And that's a big statement, because before that Wales game, it had been 7 years. So for him to say that and say it quite confidently was a lot of people questioned him with that, but he's yet to be wrong on that.
Yes. And, you know, again, not to be hypercritical of a lot of these incumbents, but what also confuses me is that they have the resources, and I assume they have the time to put in the effort. You know, poor Squidge, particularly when he started, he was pumping out content. And, you know, I can really sympathize and empathize with him as, shall we say, a fellow at-home content creator, that he, you know, he put in all the work and he put in all the analysis and came out and still has to, you know, make his own video, edit his own video, all this kind of stuff. We're not asking these pundits to edit the clips or to do anything like that. We're not even asking them to become data analysts. We're asking them to spend a little bit of time and money, for money they could probably charge to the broadcaster, by the way, of, yeah, getting someone else to look at the data and then building an opinion on that.
You're 100% right on the resources thing, because me, I'm unemployed, independent content creator who attempts to make like sophisticated content, but a lot of the time I just don't have the resources available to do it. These statistic databases are not available for the everyday person, whereas they can be available to organizations such as the public service broadcaster, the BBC. And the thing that I highlighted on Twitter was that a lot of the people were critical of mistakes that I made in my article, a couple of grammar spelling errors. And I sort of said, why are people more outraged at mistakes made by an independent non-for-profit blog than they are by blatant mistakes that are being made by the public service broadcaster, by people that are earning big salaries every year to just go on TV and just sort of wing it?
Yes. And I think that's just a classic case of low-hanging fruit, right? Where they're like, oh, he clearly doesn't know what he's talking about because he has a grammar mistake. But it's like, well, okay, potentially, but also, what do you think of the points he made? I think, yeah, we should always listen to that. And of course, once some of these journalists and analysts get picked up by a bigger media agency, there are checks and balances which make that life a lot easier around that. As in, if Johnny Wilkinson penned an article, or I'm sure he does do a few column things. And again, sorry we're using Johnny Wilkinson, but he is the perfect example of what we're talking about. No, he's not the worst. But yeah, I suppose if any of these former players do a column piece for the Times or something, the Times proofreads their article for them. So they don't have to worry about grammar issues.
Exactly. I could definitely use an editor, but it's not in the budget right now.
No, and I'm the same. I could use a sound editor. I love having these conversations and I have to spend twice as long doing the sound editing. Talking of the reaction, how was your reaction in terms of your article got quite a lot of traction amongst former players? Were you pleasantly surprised by any reactions? Were you quite disappointed in other reactions?
It was mixed emotions. It was definitely a roller coaster. It took a while to fully blow up. So early on, it was quite positive. I had a couple of former players supporting it. And the rugby Twitter community, who pretty much all agreed with me, they all loved it. But then after about 24 hours, it was shared by a certain journalist, a certain sports journalist who's big. And he decided to tag a couple people, including Jonathan Davis. And then I got responses from a lot of the mainstream pundits and broadcasters who I wrote about, both publicly on Twitter and in my direct messages. So at that point, I did get a bit stressed. I came extremely close to taking it down. I edited a lot of the parts to make it a bit more courteous, a bit less harsh. And I did tweet a public apology at one point. Not that I regret anything I said. It's just that the way I said it wasn't appropriate, just because I didn't expect any of the people that I was writing about to read it.
Yes, I have that in my own career. I'm a little bit worried that, you know, one day Johnny Wilkinson will listen to this podcast episode and never come on my show. If Johnny, if you're ever listening to this, I'm not saying you don't know what you're talking about. I'm just saying you need a little bit of help with the data analysis and I would love you to come on the podcast. And yeah, I think sometimes we can get carried away in terms of what language you use and how harsh we were saying things. But I think you'd agree with me that we're not saying that these people don't know anything about the game at all. It's just that you need to shake the boat a bit so that we get the best out of them, if I can phrase it that way.
No, that's what I said. I said to Jonathan Davis that I have the utmost respect for him as a player and what he did in his playing career. It's just that I don't see him as the best broadcaster in the world. And there's nothing wrong with that. A big part of the reaction was the fact that I got the reaction out of people made it a positive for me. Just being seen and for the views that a lot of people share was very positive for me. And I enjoyed the fact that getting the exposure and the pundits seeing it created the reaction, which maybe will change things in the future.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, you know, if I can say it to you from my perspective, your article was music to my ears because as a longtime rugby fan, it was something I'd been worrying about. And again, I think it is the purpose of a journalist, right? To speak truth to power, not to bring down the game. You know, it's not like you want less people to watch rugby. It's that you want more people to watch rugby and you want people to enjoy rugby more. And you're giving your intake in terms of what something as a rugby fan you're not enjoying. So I think it almost might then be a question of maturity, which ones turn around and say, ah, actually, this, you know, this guy's got a point. Maybe we need to ask ourselves, we need to do better. Or some will say, oh, this person doesn't know what they're talking about.
A lot of people highlighted the reaction from certain individuals in saying that they sort of proved my point, because the way they reacted to what I said was very defensive and very aggressive, rather than attempting to open up a dialogue with me and to say, oh, well, maybe you got this part right and this part right, but I'd say I'd challenge this part of what you said, which I would have thoroughly enjoyed. But instead, what I got was being called pathetic. It got called utter bollocks by a certain individual. And people were basically just telling me that they've sort of proved your point in that they're defensive because challenging the status quo is challenging them indirectly. And they know that their position may be in jeopardy.
Yes, yes. And yeah, I suppose you could say sometimes that is a natural human emotion to be worried about one's status and one's place in a system. But if the system is not generating the best possible outcome for the, you know, greatest number of people, in this case, you know, the best rugby product that it gives the fans what they want and what they enjoy, then change is required. So yeah, I hope that even in today's episode, we haven't tried to make this sound like a personal attack of anyone. It is just a comment of a mistake that's being made and something that can be rectified. If I could end with a final question, you mentioned a bit earlier, and you definitely mentioned in the article about casual rugby fans and how perhaps this kind of punditry is designed for them and, you know, just something easy to digest. How do you think we should approach this future of rugby? Because rugby is a sport a little bit under threat in terms of interest. How do we approach the sport where we get more people involved who weren't previously involved while still maintaining, you know, these standards and level of analysis that I think you and I are both rightly calling for?
Yeah, I'm happy you asked that, because rugby has a severe image problem and it has a severe superiority complex in that we don't believe that we can borrow anything from other sports. We believe that we have the best sport in the world and that other sports should be like us, which simply isn't true. Rugby's in a crisis financially. Rugby's in a crisis with the law, with litigation, with the head injury saga. So rugby is a sport that can borrow from nearly every other sport in the world. When I talk about stats and data, and I look at Monday Night Football, the Premier League show, which is very much analysis and data-driven, which has taken Premier League football to a new level. People love it. Millions and millions of viewers. The same with F1 Drive to Survive on Netflix. That's increased F1 viewership by almost double. So there's definitely an attitude problem which rugby can change, in that we can become open to borrowing things from other sports rather than seeing ourselves as the best sport in the world, which we definitely are not.
Yes. And I think the Drive to Survive, yeah, I've mentioned that a few times on this podcast. It has been a bit of a game changer in terms of how you bring fans on board. And I think the key thing that it communicated is it brought people up to speed on a lot of the narratives, and then from there launched them into the sport that they could follow normally. And yeah, I think, for example, this most recent season of Drive to Survive, which I believe is season 4, hasn't got the best reaction because, you know, it wasn't particularly well made, but it almost doesn't matter now, because those fans who love seasons 1, season 2, maybe season 3 are now just watching the sport. So it's almost done its job. And I know the Tour de France are about to do something similar, almost exactly the same kind of styled show, where within a series of a few episodes, you could bring an entire new group of fans up to speed on a sport. How great would that be in a rugby context? Because, you know, how many people can't start watching rugby because they don't know any of the players, they don't know any of the history? And yeah, and in an entertaining way, we can bring them up to speed.
And just yesterday, I saw the trailer for the Amazon Prime documentary on Harlequins, which looks amazing. I can't wait for that.
Yes. The only problem when I do it, when I think it's one of those, shall we say, individual team documentaries, is then people all start supporting that team.
Yeah, and Quins don't need new fans.
No. And by the way, there have been evidences where it hasn't worked. I know Man City did a similar one where they looked at themselves and, you know, sort of like a inside the changing room show. And it didn't land because it didn't have the sense like it was being objective, as in it was like, wow, this just says Man City's amazing and there's no critical angle. Whereas Drive to Survive was like, no, look at all these teams and look at how they're bickering with each other. That's interesting.
No, that's definitely an important point. Obviously, when you ask to go and get private access to a certain club, it would be hard to then reflect them negatively in a documentary you make about them. But at the same time, I think it will be positive for the sport, because getting the exposure and seeing, it's all about personalities. Like in rugby, we have a problem with showing personalities. We're very media trained. We're very boring in that sense. So for us to be able to go into a training ground and just talk to players and just let them show their personality, I think it's going to be huge.
Yes, and I think other teams and players are finding a way around that. And I think probably the best example of that is Joe Marler, where, you know, I was speaking to one of my friends the other day, and she's not like a big rugby fan per se, and she just loves Joe Marler because his TikToks are funny. And I'm like, well, you know, if that gets more people engaged in the game, then so be it.
The England do a series on YouTube. England rugby, they basically just go behind the scenes in the training. And it's brilliant. It's since then, I can't hate a single England player in the squad because you go behind the scenes and they're just normal people. They're just trying to enjoy their day. They work hard. And when they talk to the camera, they're so genuine and they're just people. And you don't see that in post-match interviews. You don't see that in pre-match interviews or whatever. So I think the more we can get behind the scenes and showing these individual personalities, it can only be good for the sport.
Yes, and I think that's another good point where I was speaking to another female friend, and she, again, I think she's a rugby fan, but I wouldn't describe her as a die-hard rugby fan. And she had seen like every single one of those little England behind-the-scene clips, and to the point that she had a greater knowledge of one or two of the personalities in the England squad than I did. And I was like, you know, that's not because of a case of time, effort, or passion. That is just because they've created a median to communicate that kind of stuff in an enjoyable way.
And you can see the divide again there, where a lot of the older rugby fans will dislike characters such as Kyle Sinclair and Ellis Genge being a bit too open and having a big personality. But we love them. Younger generations love them. I don't know a single young person who doesn't love Ellis Genge and love Kyle Sinclair. The bigger the personality, the more the fans will engage with them. And you can see that Joe Marler has more followers on social media than a lot of other rugby players because he has a big personality. People love that.
As a final point, the Blue Bulls rugby team in South Africa, they're causing a bit of a stir recently by creating these sort of meme-filled sort of pre-game videos, sort of a, you know, a little five-minute video before every game. And again, you know, whether they'll be able to put out that content reliably for the next year or two, who knows? But yeah, South African rugby is in a dire, dire financial state. So anything that can create that personal connection back from the fans to the players, I think we enjoy. And yeah, something to shake up the system and something to disrupt the old guard would be most welcome. So yeah, I think Ben, on that point, we'll end it. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. Enjoyed it.
No, you're very welcome. And don't be disheartened. Keep speaking truth to power, even if that is speaking truth to rugby power.
I will.
That was our interview with Ben Nurse. Again, I would like to reiterate that our intention was not to critique any of the aforementioned pundits as people, but simply to point out that times are changing and they might be currently missing a trick. Ben writes for a website called The Match Report, which I will link in the show notes. Please feel free to reach out to him or myself if you have any thoughts, counter-arguments, or new insights into today's topic. And finally, if you have a moment on your podcast app of choice, it would be a huge help if you could rate this show, assuming you enjoy it, of course. 5 stars goes a long way to help more people discover what we do here. So thanks for doing that. And thanks as always for listening. And I'll see you in the next one.